This is All Radio number one, tape number two, side one, and it starts out with ads rushing out of Limbaugh. A letter writing campaign looks to silence Rush. The Democrats want their own version of Rush Limbaugh. We'll hear how they're going about it. Then from All Things Considered, an article about consolidation and voice tracking from NPR. And speaking of NPR, we'll also have an article on old radio. Was radio just that good when we were kids? Well, we'll hear about that. Also, it looks like Wolfman Jack's going to be recognized in his former hometown of Del Rio, Texas, with a statue to be unveiled. You'll hear about it coming up on All Radio. All Radio! And then finally, on side two of this tape, we'll talk about digital audio broadcasting. And talk to somebody who knows about AM broadcasting, none other than Leonard Kahn. Radio, National Radio Club. Ads rushing out of the Limbaugh Show? Progressives take aim at radio program sponsors. By William Spain of CBSMarketWatch.com. Though still in its infancy, a letter-writing campaign aimed at advertisers on the Rush Limbaugh Show has already claimed a few choice scalps, and hopes to soon have other marketers saying, ditto. Kicked off last week on the website of a group called Take Back the Media, the effort is generating a growing buzz among online progressives, or if you prefer the term, liberals, along with hundreds of angry emails to companies that sponsor what it calls Limbaugh's hateful chortling and guffawing. Michael Stinson, a Vietnam-era veteran, is co-founder of Take Back the Media. Obviously never a Rush fan, Stinson and his cohorts were content to largely ignore the king of talk radio, until he weighed in on a recent anti-war protest, calling participants anti-American, anti-capitalist, and communists, amongst other terms. "He just went too far," said Stinson. "Don't call me anti-American. I serve this country." When he decided to go after Limbaugh, Stinson said, "We were told that we would have to nip at his heels by starting to contact local advertisers." He ignored that advice, however, and posted a list, complete with contact information, of top sponsors. Within 18 hours, Radio Shack had folded. Within 36 hours, Amtrak was gone. "And Bose told us that they were no longer advertising on the show," Stinson said. Oddly, Stinson's group is not only telling the rest of the world which companies advertise on Limbaugh's show, but apparently even the companies themselves. In Radio Shack's case, the company maintains that it did not buy ads on Limbaugh's show, and that any that did air were the result of an error made by the radio network or local affiliate. Radio Shack, the company continued, quote, "strictly adheres to a policy of not intentionally buying advertising space on a program that might be politically or socially controversial or that promotes any one individual's agenda or point of view," unquote. Amtrak said that the ads aired as part of a complicated barter deal involving Strange But True, the San Francisco Convention and Visitors Bureau, and it does not sponsor political shows and, quote, "in the future will communicate that practice to other partners," unquote. Although Stinson said that he has had reports of its ads appearing during the show, a spokesman for Bose told CBS MarketWatch that it does not advertise on the program and has no intentions of doing so. Other advertisers targeted by Take Back the Media include Darden Restaurants, Red Lobster, Pfizer, AutoZone, and the online retailer Overstock.com, none of which would comment. Limbaugh is syndicated by Premier Radio Networks, a subsidiary of radio behemoth Clear Channel Communications. While not addressing whether the show had lost any advertisers as a result of a boycott, Premier issued the following written statement. "There have been many times in the 15-year history of the Rush Limbaugh program when national and world events have generated increased listening as well as increased communication with individuals who have opposing points of view," said company president Craig Kitchen. "The kind of compelling radio that generates opposition also causes Rush Limbaugh's weekly 20 million listeners to tune in that much more and to listen longer," unquote. That audience number is likely exaggerated. Other estimates put it closer to 15 million. But there is no question that Limbaugh is big, 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 and one of the medium's biggest single stars. So can a few scrappy liberals really hurt him? Depends. A lot of radio time is bought pretty much on commodity basis, with advertisers looking for day parts and regions rather than specific programming. Many may not even know where their ads appeared until after the fact. And unless they have given their buyers upfront marching orders to avoid him, already not uncommon, Limbaugh's powerful ratings guarantee a piece of that action. Of course, there are plenty other options that can deliver similar numbers. Whether or not a boycott works to any meaningful degree is going to depend on how many more advertisers decide it's easier to switch than fight. According to radio buyers, some companies cave almost instantly in the face of even a little negative feedback, while others need to experience a truly sustained and widespread level of complaints before they'll listen. Still, they don't have to get them all to make a difference. If enough advertisers pull out, the word that the show is a forbidden zone and they are not rapidly replaced, the program will lose much of its economic value to local stations and station groups, regardless of how well its audience numbers are doing. Of course, the already loaded Limbaugh is never going to have much trouble putting food on the table, but he and his fans could end up in a less desirable time slot or on fewer outlets. Historically, the boycott approach has a mixed record. One of the most effective boycotts of recent times was against Viacom unit VH1, Music Behind Bars, a program that showcased the jailhouse jams of murderers, rapists, and assorted other scum. An outcry from victim rights groups, law enforcement officials, and politicians had advertisers staying away in droves, and the cable network quickly pulled the plug on the series. Viacom is a significant shareholder in MarketWatch.com, the publisher of this report, by the way. The Christian right attack on NYPD Blue in the early 1990s, on the other hand, was a complete failure. It initially scared off some marketers, but the program's ratings and demographics were so good that it attracted business from sectors that don't expect to sell to those folks anyways, including movies, beer, cosmetics, designer clothing, etc. And the effort completely fell apart when the first big package goods company, Unilever, jumped in. Blue eventually went on to become one of the most enduring and profitable shows in ABC's primetime lineup. What makes this attempt particularly interesting is that progressives typically eschew ad boycotts both for free speech reasons and because it is a favorite technique of their ideological opponents. Stinson, however, is unapologetic about tearing a page out of the other team's playbook. We're going to employ the tactics of those people, and it's already working. We're hitting some nerves. And the author, William Spain, is a reporter for CBSMarketWatch.com, based out of Chicago, Illinois. Dems say talk radio is left out. This article is from Shop Talk Magazine, February 3, 2003. The New York Post's John Minnelli writes that Democrats are on the prowl for their own version of Rush Limbaugh and wined and dined 36 potential contenders this week before and after President Bush's State of the Union address in Washington. But as if to validate the widely held belief that liberals can't get ratings on talk radio, the invited politicians had far more firepower than the invited guests, and the organizer even had a problem remembering who some of the liberal talk show hosts were. Most of the current folks we hear on talk radio now were themselves unheard of not long ago, said Tom Athens, executive director of Democracy Radio, organizer of the event. We're dedicated to creating more diversity in talk radio, so it's really representative of America as a whole, Athens said. I think it's a media invention that we need a liberal Rush Limbaugh. Although, our view is that the right wing dominates the airwaves at the present. Whereas the D.C. gathering featured high-powered Democratic speakers like Hillary Clinton, Ted Kennedy, Tom Daschle, and Nancy Pelosi, the only nationally recognizable talk show name on hand was Detroit gabber Mitch Albom, and only because he wrote Tuesdays with Maury. We think that there are people on the air in local markets and others who have not been heard of, who could do well, said Athens. We're looking for someone who can be entertaining, engaging, and informative at the same time. The worst thing they could do for a talk show host is anoint them with designated party hack, warned Talkers Magazine publisher Michael Harrison. Before you get the medium, you better have the right message that resonates with the American people. Then radio will follow naturally. Harrison says that he's troubled by the fact that, according to Athens, some of the invited talk show hosts were sponsored, all expenses paid. The relationship between the broadcasters and political parties should be at arm's length, even at their coziest, he said. And that article was from Shop Talk Magazine.
We're going to spend the rest of our show considering a topic close to our hearts and close to your hearts, too, we hope. Radio. In this case, we're going to examine a trend that's been drastically changing the world of commercial radio. The more you listen to various stations, the more they sound the same, and there's a crucial economic reason why. A few years ago, Congress passed a law that allows corporations to own as many radio stations as they want. Before that, there was a limit. So now, a small number of corporate owners have been gobbling up the independents. In fact, some companies own 100 stations each. And as NPR's Wade Goodwin reports, it's changing what you hear.
Some of the changes in commercial radio have been dramatic. But if you don't know what you're listening for, you might not be able to hear them on your favorite local station.
The all-new, all-hit B98 Mighty Joe on the radio, hitting the phones for a little request action. Hello, who is this?
Hi, my name is Bobby, and I like to request Tearing at My Heart by
The consolidation of commercial radio stations around the country has brought new opportunities to use advanced technology. And one effect of this coupling of corporate ownership and computer wizardry is that now what you think you're hearing on the air isn't always what you're really hearing.
In Louisiana, Saturday night, that's Mel McDaniel. I'm Don Miller, and about out of here. Hey, for a Wednesday night, coming up next, it's Steve Eberhardt.
Hey, Don, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing terrifically well.
How was the show? Did you have a good show?
Did you hear it?
No, I never listened.
You got me back.
The exchange you just listened to, two DJs yucking it up in the studio during their shift change, never happened. The DJs aren't even in the same state, and the first DJ had gone home long before his replacement ever got to work. They never actually talked to each other at all. Could you tell it wasn't real? Most people can't. This technology is called Star System, and it's a new way of doing commercial radio. It makes a station sound like it is being broadcast live locally, even though it's not. It's being used by Texas-based Capstar Broadcasting, which, along with its sister company Chancellor Media, now owns more radio stations than anyone in the country. Steve Hicks is the president of Capstar, which specializes in small and medium market radio.
What you're seeing in a market, especially a small market, is you put a bunch of radio stations together and it's a viable competitor to the newspaper. We can offer an advertiser five different stations in different formats, and we can reach a lot of people. Sometimes we have higher reach than what the local newspaper has.
Profits are way up. Capstar's operating profits are increasing at a rate of 20% a year. It has worked like this. A company like Capstar comes into a region and buys anywhere from 3 to 8 radio stations, depending on the size of the market. The stations are then combined into one building. Support staff is cut. Instead of 5 receptionists, there's only one, and only one rent payment, too. Station formats are often changed depending on what the local market research shows. If 2 competing rock stations are purchased, One may suddenly find itself playing country music the day after the deal is finalized.
101.5 KNUE, today's best new country, your all-time favorites, Travis Tritt, If I Lost You. It's 8 minutes after 12 o'clock. Doing the KNUE Country Cafe.
The town of Tyler in rural East Texas is one of those small markets that has felt the effects of consolidation. Capstar now owns 5 radio stations in Tyler. John Moore was the program director at KNUE when Capstar bought it. Moore has had a ringside seat from which to view the changes in radio that have come to Tyler.
For years, radio owners owned one station or maybe an AM and an FM combo, and everybody else was your mortal enemy in the community. Well, over time, I watched people that had been my mortal enemy set up shop down the hall, and I'd pass them going to get coffee. So it was quite different and kind of tough to get used to at first, going, hey, how you doing? Nice to see you.
Like many program directors in small markets like Tyler, Moore is also the morning drive time host. Before Capstar owned KNUE, Moore used to call down to the local music store to see which country albums were selling best. That was the extent of his market research. Not anymore.
You can pick up the phone and ask what the CD is doing, not only around here, but regionally, because they have that information. They do that research. We have consultants who find out what listeners want to hear. They test songs in auditoriums. And in that sense, that's something that we could never even dream of affording to do on a local level.
There are other differences as well. Steve Jost is a vice president of Capstar, in charge of 14 radio stations in East Texas.
When I was back in Columbus, Ohio, in my early days as a program director, we had a news department that had about 10 people. And we had a person who was stationed at the county courthouse. At one time, when I first got in this business, everybody had a news department.
Those days are probably gone forever. Now a market often has just one station, usually AM, that has a news talk format. All those radio reporters have had to find work elsewhere or take a job inside the company doing something else. And it's not just news reporters that are getting laid off. New technologies are allowing companies like Capstar to almost completely eliminate local disc jockeys.
Playing 30 years of quality rock, loud and proud. We are 96X, the classic rock station.
In Tyler, for example, only one of Capstar's 5 stations has full-time local DJs. The other stations rely on DJs in Austin, Texas, who service the local station using the STAR system. By using this computer system, each disc jockey in Austin can handle between 6 and 8 different radio stations at once. And those stations can be anywhere in the country. DJs pre-record their voice tracks and then send them to the local stations over special telephone lines. A computer then drops those voice tracks into the broadcast at a precise moment at the beginning or end of a song. For the stars of the STAR system, the DJs in Austin, this new technology turbocharges their careers. Michelle Lee is one of them. She's a DJ for 7 different Capstar stations.
It's fast and furious. In fact, after you do this and then you go back and do a live show at a radio station, you actually have to sit through every song. It gets a little boring.
Hi, KTYL, you're the 9th caller. Who's this?
Oh, this is Pam.
Hi, Pam. How are you today?
How are you?
I'm great.
Great.
Are you ready to guess?
Yes.
How much money do you think is in the KTYL Super High Low Money Jackpot?
$116.75. It's hard to tell that this is not live radio, but it's not. And it's not really local either. But this technology has allowed Capstar manager Steve Jost to cut his on-air staff in East Texas by nearly 50%. Instead of 6 or 7 disc jockeys, there is just one production assistant who babysits the computer and answers the phone. The technology is so supple, Capstar stations can even do phone-in contests long after the DJs in Austin have finished their shifts.
Hi, KTYL, your caller number 9. Who is this?
Dina.
Okay. Do you know how much is in the jackpot now?
I would guess $181.41.
Nope, you're too low.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
In a tiny, windowless room, production assistant Kristen Parker takes the phone calls after a pre-recorded DJ announces the contest on the air. As soon as the caller hangs up, she goes to work. First, she digitally cuts her voice out.
Thank you.
Right. No, thank you.
Thank you.
Right. No, thank you.
Thank you.
Then she drops the Austin DJ's voice in as a replacement.
Hey, we'll play again next hour at 4:20.
Parker is very fast. The pointer flies across the computer screen as she cuts and pastes. Less than 4 minutes later, the new version of the contest goes out on the air.
Hi, KTYL, you're caller number 9. What's your name?
Dina.
All right, so how much do you think we have in the KTYL Super High-Low jackpot right now?
I would guess 181.41.
Oh, sorry about that. You're too low this time.
Thank you.
Hey, we'll play again next hour at 4:20.
One wonders what the contestant in Tyler must think when 4 minutes later she hears herself playing the game with a DJ she's never spoken to in her life. Commercial radio has always used technology to blur the line between what is live and what is taped. But with corporate consolidation, live radio, broadcast using local disc jockeys, may slowly be going the way of the dinosaur. In a sign of just how far consolidation has progressed, out of 23 radio stations in Tyler, only one is still independently owned and operated.
Kick and country weather, flash flood watch continues in effect for us tonight, for Monday, or for Friday night football.
KKUS plays country music with live local disc jockeys. It broadcasts out of a small storefront in a strip mall. Station owner Rick Reynolds is a holdout. Reynolds has not sold his station at a big profit to one of the media corporations, and he's still doing radio the traditional way.
I believe in live radio. I've always believed in live radio. I think it gives us a distinct advantage. I believe in the creativity of live talent. It's something that's been very good to me. I came from the talent side of the business and have a very high regard for that.
Reynolds appears to be competing just fine with his one station. He says the last 2 months have been his best ever. Industry analysts say it's too soon to predict how the consolidation of the commercial radio industry is going to play out over the long haul. What is certain is that an era when radio stations were owned by local, independent operators is quickly coming to an end. I'm Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
I know it's tempting to be nostalgic. It's easy to say, what a shame what's happening to commercial radio. Radio was wonderful in the good old days. But you know what? It really was, at least sometimes. I'm talking about the 1930s and 40s. They call it the golden age of radio. Okay, every show wasn't captivating. Some of the acting sounded forced. Some of the jokes were lame. And some shows featured ethnic stereotypes. But there was often something about the writing and the characters that drew whole families to the living room. And they'd spend whole evenings together listening to the same programs. Listen to this excerpt from the Fred Allen Show in 1949. The fuzz and static sound old-fashioned, but the jokes work pretty well in 1999.
Ah, it's good to get back to Allen's Alley, Kenny. I guess the senator just washed his hair. His toupee is hanging on the line. See, the old pompadour is waving in the wind there. Well, let's knock.
Somebody put the fud to my lumber. Oh, it's you, ferret face.
Yes, Senator.
Well, let's go, son. I'm busier than a man with one tooth eating corn on the cob.
Oh, now, nobody could be that.
I'm heading the Senate committee on that new clam survey.
Clam survey?
Yeah, the government's spending $500,000 to increase clam production.
Oh.
My job's to see that the boy clams start courting the girl clams.
Senator, don't tell me the clams make love.
Son, you have no idea what goes on under them shells.
You can learn more about the golden age of radio comedies in the new book, Raised on Radio. The author's Gerald Nachman. And Nachman says if you want to understand how these old-time programs shaped what we hear today, don't turn on your radio, turn on the television.
The TV sitcoms of today, in so many formats, all stem from radio, which has been pretty much forgotten, vintage radio, as I call it.
And so when we watch a TV sitcom today, can we basically say, this is old stuff, they were doing it on radio in the 1930s?
Oh, absolutely.
Here's a curious item in Nachman's book. The radio comedy shows took off largely because of the Great Depression in the 1930s. For one thing, people couldn't afford to do much else for entertainment. Listening to the radio was free. But there's a more direct connection. A lot of vaudeville theaters shut down during the Depression. The actors lost their jobs. So suddenly, there was a glut of comedians looking for work. And radio producers created whole new shows to feature them. Comedians who depended on physical gags, comedians who made people laugh with their bodies, didn't make it on radio. Groucho Marx was a radio flop. On the other hand, radio made a vaudeville comedian named Jack Benny.
The Lucky Strike program starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Rochester, Dennis May, Bob Crosby, the Sportsman Quartet, and yours truly, Don Wilson.
Jack Benny was able to make it in radio because he had created a personality. He used radio better than anybody else. George Burns once said of Benny, "No one was better suited for radio than Jack. Radio consisted of sound and silence. That was it. While the rest of us were trying to figure out ways of using sound, Jack was smart enough to figure out how to use the silence."
Phil, what are you doing around here?
Well, Jackson, there's something I want to talk to you about.
Oh, what is it?
Jackson, I want to borrow some money.
Money? How much?
$2,000.
You know, Phil... You don't feel life is funny.
People became so familiar with his character traits, his stinginess, his vanity, that a topic could be mentioned, money could be mentioned, his age could be mentioned, and people would know what he was thinking because the character was so familiar to the audience that there could be a pause, and the pause would, while the pause was going on, people would realize what Benny was thinking. And that's what made him so unusual and really made the show different.
But Jackson, now wait a minute. You can't turn me down. I gotta have $2,000.
Phil, what in the world do you need all that money for?
Well, after we go off the air this summer, I'm going on tour with my orchestra.
On tour?
Yeah, and we're gonna go to Texas, then Louisiana, then through Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia.
Why are you only going through the South?
Look, Dad, I only know one song, and I ain't taking no chances.
It's sort of refreshing for young actors today, I think, to know that when Jack Benny first started out on radio, he bombed at first. I mean, his show was a flop.
Yeah, he was terrible, mainly because there was no audience in those days. The networks didn't allow audiences, and comedians had to play basically to the band leader or to themselves. Networks were afraid that if people at home heard the studio audience laughing, that it would interfere with the flow of the show. And so they erected a large glass screen, and the audience would sit behind that. And Benny said he always knew when to start the next line when he saw people's mouths closing.
the sponsors canceled him.
Yeah, he was sponsored by Canada Dry. He was called the Canada Dry Comedian, but he was picked up right away by Jell-O.
And actually, that raises a really critical issue in broadcasting, which is the way that the radio show started a trend which now we take for granted, and that is whenever you turn anything on the radio or on the television, one of its main goals is not just to entertain you, it's to hawk a product. And you write in your book that no show did this more than Amos and Andy.
The makers of the new Rinso bring you the Amos and Andy Show with their guest tonight, Mr. Charles Coburn. There's plenty of excitement around tonight because radio history is being made. The new Rinso presents the new Amos and Andy Show. Yes, everything brand new. New in the fact that Amos and Andy are doing for the first time a half-hour show. New in that Amos and Andy are playing before an audience, also for the first time. And new in that each week there will be a famous guest. Tonight, Mr. Charles Coburn. And there's plenty of news about Rinso, too. Try it yourself. I'm sure you'll agree it's absolutely tops. That its soapy rich suds get out more dirt. That in short, it's the ideal soap for wash day, for dishes, and for all the soap and water jobs around the house. Yes, try Rinso. I know you'll join the vast army of women who whistle while they wash. And now, the new soapy rich Rinso presents the new Amos and Andy Show.
The products were tied in with the shows, often very... cleverly, they would interweave the commercial into the body of the show. And on Amos and Andy, of course, I think what you're referring to is an early Amos and Andy show that proved how important radio was as an advertising medium. There was a famous episode on the Amos and Andy show in which the character of Amos's wife, Ruby, was mortally ill, and the audience was afraid she was going to die. And they were so upset by it that they sent in letters and protests to the sponsor, Pepsodent, saying they were going to boycott the show and not buy Pepsodent if she didn't live.
They'd stop using Pepsodent toothpaste, and they would switch to their big competitor, Colgate.
Yes, right. And so to prove the viability of advertising, they decided that she would live, and she did live, and so Ruby and Pepsodent went on to live a long and happy life.
Now, Amos and Andy, you write, was the most popular radio show of all time. It lasted from when? From the 30s to the 60s?
Yes, it did, in various formats. It started out as a 6 times a week, 15-minute serial, and it was so popular, they would pipe it into department stores and into movie theaters, and they would stop the movie, I guess, and play the Amos and Andy show. And President Coolidge said he was not to be disturbed during that 15 minutes, 7 to 7:15 every night.
Now, Amos and Andy is, these days at least, somewhat controversial in the history of American broadcasting. Briefly tell us what the plot was, such as there was a plot, and what made it so controversial.
They began as a couple of sharecroppers who moved up to Chicago to seek their fortune, or to improve themselves, actually. And then they ended up, when the show went network, after it was in Chicago, they moved to Harlem.
So you're going away for the weekend, Amos. Sure hope you have a nice time.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Tell me, Amos, who is you leaving in charge of the department?
Well, I ain't figuring on having nobody here.
How about burglars?
Yeah.
Well, I went away before, and I just locked the place, and nothing was stole.
Oh, maybe the burglars didn't get around to you yet.
Yeah, I guess they're short-handed, just like everybody else.
But you see, fellas...
Amos, look here. These burglars work the thing in alphabet order. Now, you just lucky, because your name is Jones. They ain't got down to you yet. Andy, is you here where the burglars is down to now?
Yeah. I heard they was just finishing the letter before J, whatever that is.
Now, Amos and Andy, you write in the book that when you look back on those days from the vantage point of 1998, Amos and Andy remain a Rorschach blot. What do you mean by that?
Well, you can read into it anything you like. Amos and Andy was played by two white men who created them, Freeman Gosden and Charles Correll, and it divided the black community right down the middle. Some of the black newspapers thought it was a demeaning caricature. Other black newspapers, just as important, thought it was harmless and great humor. And part of the appeal of the show, I think, is that it came along right at the time of the Depression, and they were two guys who were struggling, trying to make it, and a lot of people identified with them, people of any color, because they were really such warm, human characters. They were beloved, and if you listen to them over the years, they became an institution. George Bernard Shaw said famously when he left America, the only thing he remembered was the Grand Canyon, I think Yosemite, and Amos and Andy.
Gerald Nachman is the author of Raised on Radio. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Daniel.
Gerald Nachman has been speaking to us from member station KQED in San Francisco.
And thanks to Mike Dukin for that recording from NPR's All Things Considered. Del Rio to Honor Wolfman Jack, by John McCormick of the San Antonio Express News. Nearly four decades later, lawyer Arturo Gonzalez can still clearly picture the polite, dark-haired East Coast disc jockey who showed up without notice at his Pecan Street office back in late 1963. Wolfman Jack got his start in Del Rio four decades ago on XERF, a super-powered station that broadcasts from Mexico. 7 years after his death, fans and city fathers are planning a statue and a museum. He introduced himself as Bob Smith, and he wanted to know who was the owner of the radio station, XERF, recalls Gonzalez, 94, who at the time sold advertising contracts in the United States for the superpower station in Mexico. I said, "What can you do?" And he said, "I'm a radio announcer, and I can sell whatever you have to sell." And I think he was on the radio station that same night selling baby chicks, $100 for $2.98, Gonzalez said, chuckling. Once on the air, the mild-mannered, clean-cut Smith became howling, growling Wolfman Jack. And the rest, as they say, is rock and roll history. Now, nearly 40 years after he left XERF for another superpower station in Tijuana, Mexico, and 7 years after his death from a heart attack, the Wolfman is coming back to Del Rio. If all goes well, at this time next year, a larger-than-life bronze statue of the great caped howler will loom over a downtown intersection. A Wolfman Jack museum and a music festival will be in the works. During his 6 months in Del Rio, the late-night XERF DJ mesmerized teenagers across America and beyond with his radio annex, ultra-hip delivery, and anything-goes playlist. His border broadcasts were powered by a 250,000-watt transmitter, 5 times the juice allowed on the U.S. side. Wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I want you to lay your hands on the radio, lay back with me and squeeze my knobs. We're going to feel it tonight. Ow! This is Wolfman Jack down here. With the donkeys, we're going to get you some soul. And he would howl. Get naked, blow the evil weed, kiss your teachers. Wolfman play the best records in the business and then he eat 'em, growled the looping mystery man, according to the book Border Radio by Gene Fowler and Bill Crawford. The Wolfman was an instant sensation, Gonzalez recalls, after soon he hit the airwaves, hawking everything from chicks to fertility pills. Advertising sales boomed, and he had to hire another dozen young women to handle the flood of orders. He was bringing in a lot of money, and when he left, the sales went way down, he said. But in the grand vision that Del Rio mover and shaker Jay Johnson has for his dusty border city, the Wolfman can still make cash registers ring. Del Rio deserves to be a hotshot town, and it will be, and Wolfman Jack will be the seal of the deal, he said. This thing is going to be flat-out explosive. Wolfman Jack was really the catalyst who put together the world of rock and roll. He was heard in Australia, in Asia, in Europe, and Canada, said Johnson, who owns a bed and breakfast and several restored buildings here. So far, all systems are go. A nonprofit foundation is being formed, and Del Rio officials have signed on to the project, as have Wolfman's widow, Lou Smith of North Carolina. I'm just tickled pink that they want to do that. Del Rio is the place where Robert W. Smith became Wolfman Jack, she said. Michael Maiden, a nationally known sculptor, is already at work on a model, and former Wolfman publicist Mike Venema is looking up old buddies from James Brown to Alice Cooper to help out. 3 weeks ago, Venema and Maiden, who is based in Oregon, came to Del Rio and met with Johnson and other local boosters. Both came away sold on the project. We're committed to Del Rio. It's the perfect place. And Acuna was fantastic as well. It was very reminiscent of an earlier time, he said. Maiden, appropriately best known for his wildlife sculptures, grew up on a ranch near Walla Walla in eastern Washington and had his first encounter with the Wolfman when he was 13 or 14. I'd listen to him late at night on my radio, my little Montgomery Ward transistor radio. He would fade in and then fade out, recalls Maiden, who is now 52. And I thought he was a black man. Most people did. And he kind of perpetuated that. He was one of the DJs who made black music popular, he said. Until late in his career, no one knew what he looked like. I almost certainly didn't until American Graffiti, the 1973 hit movie by George Lucas, in which the Wolfman played himself. The sculptor is coy about exactly what the bronze Wolfman will look like. My job is to try and make this icon recognizable. He was wild and a crazy guy, and kind of a whimsical character, and he's not going to be straightened up or down like Jefferson Davis, he said. Both Maiden and Venema said that they are confident the $130,000 needed for the sculpture will be easily raised once the word gets out. For Del Rio, a quiet border city on U.S. 90, known to most travelers as no more than just a gas stop on the way to West Texas and the Big Bend National Park, a hip tourist attraction is sorely needed. The Wolfman Project has surfaced just as Del Rio is launching a revitalization of Main Street, a dowdy thoroughfare of retail shops and fading classical buildings. The city recently won backing for the Main Street project from the Texas Historical Commission, and coordinator Ginger Lyons said Wolfman Jack fits right in. Include him in our Main Street plan is vital. We could use any tourist attraction we can get. Everyone here knows the story of Wolfman Jack, and we're very proud of him, she says. If Wolfman Jack does for Del Rio what another rock icon has done for Lubbock, the project could prove to be a real magnet. Each year, 35,000 to 40,000 people visit the Buddy Holly Museum, which opened in 1999. Many people come here because Buddy Holly was from here. They come to Lubbock, Texas for that reason alone. We get people from Britain, Australia, and all over Europe, said Connie Gibbons, museum director. The official launch of the Wolfman Jack project in Del Rio is set for March 15th. And at that time, the model of the statue of the most famous DJ may be unveiled. The museum would feature Wolfman artifacts and photos to tell his life story. But given the Wolfman's love for invention and hyperbole, exactly what happened here 40 years ago may never be known. In his autobiography, Have Mercy, the Wolfman gives a lurid, action-packed account of his arrival at Del Rio and his armed takeover of XCRF, later known as the Wolfman Jack Radio Shootout Saga. Actually, according to an account, the Wolfman and a buddy arrived in Mexico to find XCRF in receivership and quickly engineered a coup to reclaim it from hostile hands. With guns and bribes, lawsuits and hustles, according to the Wolfman tale, he took over XCRF. Then he remade his programming from a loony collection of huckster preachers and hillbilly music. The original Carter family, Johnny Cash's future in-laws, had broadcast to the nation from the studio's high-powered towers to become the hottest rock station in the world, led by the most notorious underground DJ. I was truly glowing in those days on XCRF, because I was a young buck doing my thing right where I always wanted to be, hitting the airwaves with gale force rhythm and blues, and the most soulful rock and roll all sent your way through the treetop tall platinum-coated driver tubes of the most powerful commercial station on the planet, Wolfman wrote. According to the book, the final battles for XCRF were won in a shootout in a cheap Del Rio hotel between the Wolfman and Montez, the evil Mexican who wanted to reclaim the station, and the follow-up ambush in the desert. I still got a little crease in the end of my nose from that first bullet. The second one dug into the back of the van's door frame, 6 inches behind where my head had been, wrote Wolfman about the late-night ambush. Lou Smith also has vivid memories of Del Rio as a cowboy town with a Spanish flavor. She said the men who met her husband on the Mexican side of the bridge wore guns and cartridge belts crisscrossed on their chests. And much of what Wolfman wrote about actually happened, including problems with rival factions and the Federales and the late night on-the-air cry for help from XCRF, Smith said. We were staying in the Del Rio Hotel. As we were falling to sleep, listening to the radio, they broke right into the show and started yelling, "Pistoleros! Pistoleros!" They were calling for the police and for help, she recalled. Wolf jumped up and went over there to help those guys, and I don't know exactly what he did. Arturo Gonzalez only chuckles when told of such accounts. 40 years later, he remembers no lawsuits, no shootouts, and no armed takeovers. Only a polite and reliable guy named Bob Smith, who, when seated behind the microphone, became a jive-talking crazy man. If you met him, you probably wouldn't think that much of him. But on the radio, he brought out a lot of excitement, and a lot of people were happy to listen to him, he said. He was very impressive, very dedicated, and very reliable. We believe everything he would tell us. That's the kind of relationship it was, he said. And said Gonzalez, a Del Rio memorial to the Wolfman is long overdue. He was my friend, and I think he deserves it. He put Del Rio on the map, and he was a good man. If he could help anyone, he would. That's the kind of man that I remember, he said. And that's Del Rio to honor Wolfman Jack by John McCormick. New Mexico FM licensee fined for EAS breaches. The chief of the Federal Communications Commission Enforcement Bureau, September 26, 2002, issued a monetary forfeiture in the amount of $12,700 against Alpine Broadcasting Limited, licensee of station KKIT-FM in Angel Fire, New Mexico, and Alpine Broadcasting Limited Partnership, licensee of station KXMT-FM in Taos, New Mexico, for willful violation of Part Number 11.35A of the Commission's Emergency Alert System Rules, that is EAS. The EAS provides the president and state and local governments with the capability to provide immediate emergency communications and information to the general public. Section 11.35 of the rules provides that broadcast stations are responsible for ensuring that the EAS encoders, EAS decoders, and attention signal generating and receiving equipment used as part of the EAS are installed so that the monitoring and transmission functions are available during the times the stations and systems are in operation. The forfeiture arose from Alpine's failure to have operational EAS equipment at the two stations. The absence of the equipment surfaced during station inspections in August of 2001. There were no entries in the station's log indicating that EAS equipment had ever been operational or had been taken out of service for repairs. Alpine did not dispute those violations. The amount in the forfeiture was less than $16,000 recommended by the district director of the commission's Denver field office. The reduction reflects the bureau chief's consideration of Alpine's overall history of compliance with the commission rules, but was less than the significant reduction requested by Alpine, who claims an inability to pay, failure to comply due to relocation, and prompt remediation were rejected. And in a related story, Commission announces EAS decoder installation deadlines. The chief of the Technical and Public Safety Division of the Federal Communications Commission Enforcement Bureau announced September 19, 2002, that low-power FM stations must install certified emergency alert system decoders within a year of publication of the chief's public notice in the Federal Register. In the same notice, the division chief declared that cable systems serving fewer than 5,000 subscribers may comply with the Commission's October 1, 2002 EAS installation deadline by installing an FCC-certified EAS decoder in place of a encoder-decoder unit. This provision has been enacted by the Commission in February, contingent upon such a device becoming suitable and available by October 1st. The announcement followed the Commission's July 23rd grant of an equipment authorization for an EAS decoder unit to manufacturer TFT Incorporated. The emergency alert system is governed by Part 11 of the Commission's rules. At this time, please flip over your tape to Side 2 of All Radio Number 1.